Welcome. Okay. I want to introduce Patrick Barron. His presence here tonight allows for broader, more intense focus on the representation and interpretation of the non-human natural environment, on the positive alternatives to neglect of the environment, and the stimulus to look again in new ways by means of all literatures, including film, as we will see tonight. Associate Professor of English and Director of the Professional Writing Program at UMass Boston. Patrick Barron's areas of interest and scholarship include 20th century American and Italian poetry, environmental literature and eco-criticism, Native American literature, professional writing, and literary translation. He is a poet, essayist, editor, literary critic, and an internationally recognized literary translator. For his work as editor and translator of the selected poetry and prose of Andrea Zanzotto, Patrick was awarded the Rome Prize, a Fulbright, and an NEA grant. This volume, Translations of the Renowned European Poet's Work into English, has drawn from 14 of Zanzotto's books of poetry and a selection of his essays. Patrick's introduction for this book reveals the heart of Zanzotto's ideas, describes changes in his poetic forms, points out the relationship of his writing to historical times and places, and affectionately describes his experiences working closely with Zanzotto on these translations in Italy. Patrick depicts Zanzotto's increasing interest and encounters with, quote, social, political, and historical realities, such as the corpses from World War I that remain under the surface of the landscape. Patrick explains, quote, rather than seek an elevated subject matter and pure diction, Zanzotto here signals what will become in later work a radical shift in attention to all aspects, including the most fragmented and disturbing historical depths and details of the landscape, as well as every conceivable form of speech. Soon he will embrace the idea that literally everything speaks, and as such is fit for verse. Patrick's most recent editing achievement in collaboration with Manuela Mariani is the book Turan Vag, Interstices at the Edge of the Pale, published by Routledge in 2014. This volume examines wasted pieces of ground in urban empty spaces, such as derelict lands, loose spaces, dead zones, and wilds, anticipating the possibility of positive perspectives for these areas if we look closely and do not avert our eyes. Among his many articles, The Actual Universe as a Geography, Charles Olson's Explorations of Dogtown in the Maximus Poems, was published by the Worcester Review, Volume 27. Patrick.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Dorothy, and for the lovely introduction to Garrett and to Henry for inviting me up here. It's wonderful to come to Gloucester and also to just get away from home for a day or maybe two, depending on how late I stay up tonight and if I miss my train or who knows what'll happen. But I've been in super daddy mode the last few years, so it's good to be up here. And the last time I was here was, I guess, just before the snow hit. I was wandering around Dogtown with a friend, a new faculty member from at UMass, who is a medievalist but also is very interested in contemporary poetry. So he was excited to see Dogtown. So, you know, since you talked about Zanzotto, I hadn't planned to read any of his work, but I'll read one of his poems to make that connection. Yeah. And then I'll dive into what I've prepared for today. Let's see.
In Italian, too?
Yeah, if you'd like, yeah. You can read it in Italian, too. Okay, so this is in Italian, it's non si sa quanto verde, or there's no telling how much green is buried under this green. So it's a poem that, like many of his poems, is interested in this matrix of landscape and layers or palimpsest. You think of the landscape as a palimpsest, layers and layers that you can partially read and maybe can't read, but if you have some memory of the place, they're visible to you. So I'll read the first section at least. So there's no telling how much green is buried under this green, nor how much rain under this rain. Many are the infinities that here converge, that from here wander off, oblivious, stupefied. There is no telling. This is the relic of that rainy relic, the green in which the extreme of the green is weaving. Perhaps there's no telling for a deaf movement of light distilling itself in an ephemeral sound and knowing, perhaps allowing, blooming, extending, combining, member to member, rejoining. And I'll read the same section in Italian. Non si sa quanto verde si è sepolto sotto questo verde, né quanta pioggia sotto questa pioggia. Molti sono gli infiniti che qui convergono, che di qui si allontanano, dimentichi intontiti, non si sa. Questo è il relitto, di tale relitto piovoso, il verde in cui sta reticendo l'estremo del verde. Forse non si sa per un sordo movimento di luce, si distilla in un suono effimero e sa, forse si lascia sfiorare, si sporge, congiunge membra a membra, ritorce. It's better in Italian. But, you know, I tried. Okay. On that note, I think I'll jump into what I've prepared. There's a visual element to this as well. See how it works. Yeah. I'll chat a little bit about what I'm about to read. So these are poems that have appeared in various small zines or magazines or megazines, how you call them. So online and in actual hard copy of various sorts. But thank you. So something I experimented, these are all photographs that I took in Italy, in Abruzzo, which is in a region east of Rome. If you go directly east of Rome, almost to the Adriatic, there is a very mountainous area that is known for the karstic or limestone formations. And a lot of my work is engaged with what you would call cultural geography. So looking at how landscape forms people, and people also form landscape. And I spent a number of many years wandering around this mountain called the Maiella. It's a massif of around 66 or so peaks over 2,000 meters in height. So they go up to almost 10,000 feet, and the little villages scattered around. It's an area that was heavily impacted by the Second World War. A lot of villages were destroyed, partially or wholly, kind of somewhat rebuilt. And so these photographs, as you'll see, are they look as if perhaps they're completely wild landscapes, but they're very human landscapes that were formed by shepherds and other people, and they're overgrown, so they're very much interstices of human and non-human activity. So I'll read a few of these poems that I've kind of composed in keeping with these slides. Some will, I think, match, as, and some you'll see will kind of be on their own, but we'll go from here. So the first is above Fosso Margano, which is a place that I found on the map. It's a name that maybe no one even remembers anymore, but it's on the map, and it was spoken at some point. So these place names I find interesting, but I'm not sure how well they're even, if they're used much anymore. So 10 slides, 10 steps. I've taken 10 pictures as I walked. So with each step, I took a picture. The idea is that this the title Disrupted Landscapes is connected to this, what I call, these are disrupted films. So the idea of, rather than resorting to like video per se, This is, each perception is disrupted by a step. You have to make the connections visually between the different slides. So here we go. Femurs and tremors lay crossed behind points, such as knolls where there grows the seduction of forms whose decay has slowed to a fragile seeming stasis, touch the illusory hypothesis, futile hope that certain relics are forever, that the hardness of bone will leave a legible trace, a fragment of verse beyond the trap of a lifetime, beyond the borders of fields that inevitably bleed, become fissures, then deltas, then seas of pure salt. This poem is actually... This poem is called Cuddled or Coddled. You're not cuddling or coddling. No, so cuddled or coddled, then swatted outside. To blend or to bleed the offshoots or offspring that sweep through in waves, copy our faces, our meanings or manners, our wishes or knowings, and carry them unto the grave, yet not without pausing to prevaricate, procreate, scatter their kin, and evermore onward, till cycles do sin, and surfaces flip in mubious strips within strings of our cells the color of rot. This is a poem called Nearly Familiar. Across la macchia. Macchia is stain or blemish, but la macchia in Italian also refers to, I guess, you some like the chaparral, if you live in California or been there. So you look at places that don't have trees, but various kinds of shrubs that look as if they're kind of stained. Someone like threw paint on a hillside or something. So 75 steps, 15 slides. There's more of a gap between the images. It's a little harder to make the connections, but you'll see sometimes it's easier, sometimes it isn't. How much of a landscape is memory, light flickering in our heads, while outside, the kinesthetic touchings of place, built on place, insist as they suggest, pull down as they push out, bring to the surface a nearly familiar change of skin that begs from within, from without, to be greeted as kin? Or is it simply the usual sweating of the soil, the daily rise and fall of clods within clods, the slow eruption of forms we thought was home? And this is near the Colle della Civita. Well, hard to explain, but Colle is hill, and Civita is like not civilization, but sort of civilness or like it's. There are these stone structures that are drywall huts. That does anyone know the Trulli houses in Puglia in southern Italy? They're drywall conical houses on the coast that they look like hobbit houses, and they're fascinating. But these are shepherd sort of versions that were used for shelter. They could sleep in them, but they're very rough. But anyways, in the 1940s, one of the last masters of building these, before they fell out of use completely, built this complex of huts and sort of pens for animals all out of stone. So this is fairly near that. Okay. So along the outside. Oh, and this is, in fact, one of these. So it's not the complex. But resolution. Resolution, a fine tuning and forcing of the will, a bit of belief and concentration aimed at the edges of edges, tangible abysses with palpations, living matter muttering beyond the door, who to let in, let loose, a tree felled, a soul gone sour, but it's a seasonal thing, all may pass into itself again, shedding what burns becomes fodder, a true feeling, loss along the outskirts, where a stone is distinct and forgettable, unlocatable. This is on the Pagliarone. These are beech forests. This is around March, I guess. So it's still pretty cold. Raked. This poem is called Raked. The winter-stripped branches remind me of losses, hair raked into snarls of wire or rough twine, heart fibers or stretchy connective tissue, binding muscles to bone to muscles to skin, turned stiff along the edges, most hit by rain and sun, where the passage of space confirms time sticking, the slow journey of the earth around itself, around the disappearing sun, whose wake is made of chill becoming cold air, whose fingers tap at the friable window of my chest, poke through to the point where the distance and direction between pale green and ash gray are unclear, obscured by an uncertain shift in season. And the last of these that are like written with these little disrupted films, as I call them, is called Unlikely Map. And this area is called Lower Guardia Grelle. It's a little village on the slopes, lower slopes of this massif. And you'll see it's not very touristic. A web of topographies stitched one within, without the others, a bliss blemish, a spreading, sawing of plots, parcels, acres, in quadrants, measured immeasurably, an immemorial record of comings, goings, of here, nether, there, where the human and non-human join phalanges in a farcical funeral dance, a celebration of rites gone bad, an improper proper burial, a trading of skins. And what I'll do now is, this is a lot of slides, and I walked through from a little village called Caramanico into this valley called the Orfento Valley. I took these kind of obsessive photographs one after the other as I was walking, once in the kind of late winter, early spring, and then again in the late spring, and I interspersed them. So you'll see that this is obviously late winter, and then we have early spring. So just to confuse you even further, I suppose. But so I layered them one after the other, and I'll just let this go by itself, and I'll read a number of poems. These poems that I've been reading date back about, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. So I'll read a few of those and then move to some more recent poems. And there's a group at the end that I'm working in now that I'll read from, and I'll introduce those at that point. So this poem is called Dowsing Liming. So like you're dowsing for water, which someone showed me how to do once, and it actually worked. Mm-hmm. I found a water pipe in his house. It was in Nevada. Well, there isn't. I don't think it'd work here because you'd find it everywhere. So dowsing, liming, like in the edges of things. So it's scratchings, etchings, nudgings towards other edges that liminally glimmer, vaguely imprecisely, divide, multiply spaces. A little thought for each fetching acre, however stretched or shaped by snarls of desires that snare, pull into nooks, notions going to seed over the crooked earth. This is a four-part poem that appeared in Ditch, the online journal of experimental Canadian poetry, of all things, but I'll just read the third section, I guess. Second and third. So, mentions, meditations, a bit of pollen grasps it all. In loosening, loses track, As seeds burst furrows of other seeds in an orgy of seeds and seed casings, fruit and fodder climb the walls, indicate the obfuscated obvious, tendril in hand, a tiny tickling communicant with roots meters upon meters. Vespers vigils of kempt fields, unkempt woods, hushed whispers, pre-industrial fibers, filigrees of stuff we were once made of, then again, harpsichord serenades, cicadas, cicadas, serendipitous thunderings, storms in the distance, cloudy cool weather, and gusts, always gusts, of what the hill or sky provides. It is thus that systems and fidelities, the vast realm of spirits living and dead, are knitted together in a weave always frayed, fraying of splotchy vision, sun and shade, inside the eye. Here are a few poems from a manuscript I've been working on that it's like a four-part manuscript where there are poems, little prose passages, and road signs that I transcribed as I went along, kind of random road signs, and then quotes, random quotes that seem to relate. So I call it indices. It seems like everything is indexing itself in a strange way, and it's based on a walking and biking trip that I took down the ridge of the Apennines. There really aren't very trails. There are no real marked trails, and I just kept getting lost. But I made my way all the way to Naples, pretty much. And I didn't take a camera this time. It's like enough cameras. So here are a couple of poems from that manuscript. Abysses. The animal pleasure of wandering, abrupt spiny meadows, scratchy trails, erasure of a fraction of the self underfoot, many expanses, exposures, irradiations, materializations, and then abysses in abundance, choked with green, that seem to ask, with what invisible, impossible, gumption, in abeyance, subsidence, abiding, patiently waiting with shoulders to the wheel, does this crawling, creeping earth keep at it? I gotta wonder sometimes. And this is Vagaries. We haven't even left the village. Oh, sorry. It takes a while, I guess. It's a beautiful valley, actually, that apparently there are, once you get into it, there are freshwater otters that still survive there. And if you get far enough into it, it goes on for miles. There are some ruins of medieval monasteries that are carved into the sides of the limestone. One is from the 13th century, and to get into it, you have to crawl on your belly on this little, there are little steps hewn into the rock, and then you crawl on your belly on this little ledge that kind of reaches to this point. And as you're crawling and pulling yourself across, thinking there's no way to go back, you see all these buttons in the crevices of the rock, and what's going on? And you get in, and there's a little altar where the monks used to live in Perry, I guess, and there's a container full of buttons for all the pilgrims that make it, because as they panic and they start pulling themselves and their buttons pop off, and it's a rite of passage. So there are hundreds and hundreds of buttons in this little cup on the altar, and you wouldn't think that people could ever get up there early, but they do from the villages once a year. So that's down this trail and up the mountain, which you can see in the distance there a little bit. So vagaries, the vagaries of map making, slopes that are flat, fountains that appear out of nowhere, and a hovel that extends the empty invitation of the lines of a silent swarming trail, first a thorny meadow, then a rough road that leads to a pass like the other passes, with only a slim shadow of commerce, ticks and traps, unmarked legions of leaves that point nowhere, a stone with fatigue that looks like thousands of other stones, shuddering boughs, birds launched into flight, then a face, not a face, a human crouched behind a knoll, only a knoll. Right. So two more poems from this manuscript. So each a lapse. It's not quantity, but counting. Who could forget, forgo, let fall these worries, loose his ankles at sleep, or necklaces clinking into a bowl, fingers pinching, restricting the flow, links each a lapse or a pause, a reason that laps against shores, foreheads crossed with contagious notions, deities or fantasies, lacunae woven, wormed through by obsessive numbers. A little bit about walking and counting and thinking about, I don't know, you go nuts pacing sometimes and you go walk for days. Anyway, derivations. Derivations, lines that lead, follow other lines, nerves and nexes, bursts, rivulets, gushings of monotonies, punctuated ecstasies, then stasis, again pushed downhill through boulder fields of fates, into burrows beneath our feet, the urge, more than an urge, to express the excavation, vacancy, vacillation, then plunging headfirst along trails never before thought like this, rendered minimally familiar, then vanished behind heels, dust-caressed rocks, irregular yet semper fidelis motions that orate, gesticulate, life lives, patternings of feet, strides that hit, omit nothing. All right, I think I'll read one last poem from this group, and then there are a series of very short, compressed, kind of haiku-like poems that I've been writing recently that I suppose relate something to the time I have as a parent. Composition time has to be shortened, and maybe it's all for the better. We'll see. So this piece is coming out in a journal called Bone Shaker, which is all about cycling, sort of it's a literary cycling magazine out of Colorado. So you know what a bone shaker is? It's an old bicycle that would really shake your bones, those big wheels, you know, wooden wheels. And I was biking, actually, so that's why I suppose this poem isn't going to appear in this publication. So it's called Punto Panoramico, or what would you call it, viewpoint or something. So roads blossom in grains, sands of slopes, elopings of self with space as landscapes rustle by, perceptions, caressings, affections in every petal, push to the limitless mix, panorama and mind that pant up partitions, ensembles, homages, celebrations, confessions, ranting, some sort of rhyme or hidden music, plus a careful, listless listening, an elopement of mind, surging sequences, past passes, the wind speaks, pearls of grains, animal perception, eyes and muzzles, muses in the meadow, tenses past the moment, in motion, motes, the dust drama, bones down the creek, enjambments of banks, ankles, inklings of antecedents, who seeded the lineaments of this soil, this sacrament, this parchment? So the idea is like riding your bike down this road and things are just blowing by you and trying to sort of get a sense of that with you. So this is a collection of poems I called Brachiated Taxonomies, but they're all written in the Arnold Arboretum, really close to where I work as a parent. Maybe that's why I'm saying work, change the diaper. I walk there often, and with my first son, he would sleep a lot in the stroller, and so I'd have maybe an hour or so to, if I was lucky, maybe half an hour to walk around and write. So these are poems that are observations, they're based on observations of trees. They're about trees, but you might not necessarily understand that they're about trees. I mean, they're about, like, if you really look at these trees, the poems seem like, I tried to be very accurate in the way I'm describing them, but they might not seem so literal to me. So let's see. And I wouldn't, like, and all the trees in the Arnold Arboretum have little metal tags that have Latin names of them. And I wouldn't look at them until afterwards. So sometimes it was kind of funny. Like, the poems seemed to kind of speak to the Latin names. Other times, you know, not at all, but it's kind of a surprise. So, I'll read a series of these and then I'll end. Here we go. Okay. So, Pinus Corianus. So, Pino, I know you. You are close to my heart. Who knows why amorous world odorous wood stir the emotions so? And I, growing up in the West, the sight, the scent of pine trees really does something to me. So, especially here, this dry pine smell. What's going on? So, all right. Do you know what a pollard is? Like a, it's often a willow, or it's a tree that is constantly pruned, and it looks sort of dwarfing or something. But it's it was a peasant practice to keep trees sort of contained, but also to use the sapling, a little teeny spring growth for making baskets and things. So this isn't a real pollard, but it looked like one. So fir is guardian of its own and our propriety. Stickle-armed pollard by age or event or fault, what fruits do you bear? That's Malus sylvestris. And this is a poem about a very spiny tree that apparently is endangered and only lives on slopes in a certain mountain in China, but I didn't know that at the time. You rake me, it's full of these really kind of violent-looking spikes sticking out of it. You rake me over the dead grass with purple spines, daggers for foragers with sticky mouths, a porcupine tree, food for a porcupine. Gleditia vestitia. Outstretched episodes, distal distaffs, how much flower power, violet tiny violences, oh, so demented and scintillating. Prunus serotina. This is a chestnut tree that I just lied at. I decided to lie down underneath it in the winter, and I was just struck by the colors. So stereopic, negative positives, gray, green, black branches, electrocuting blue. That's Castanea molosissima. Could it be a hairy enzyme with a fetter of spring in the shape of, with a terror of, blossoms and fill? That's Metasequoia glypsostroboides, for what it's worth. I like these Latin names. They just suggest things to me sometimes. Okay. My follicles are drooping. So please pick my bushy head clean of red. This was in the, it was snowy, and there was this sad looking, I guess it was a crabapple, teeny red fruits, just ready to fall off and be done with life. So and this is a tree that, some kind of willow, I guess, but the branches made me think of ampersands. I looked up, and it was interesting, the alphabet used to include the ampersand at the end, and you know, it's et, it comes from et, which means and apparently when children would recite the alphabet at the end, they go and per se and, like and by itself and, so it's kind of funny. It was not part of the alphabet, apparently. So an ample ampersand, arrows end in pinpricks, a tendril for a sea of tendrils. And this is just one that I wrote walking around, but like Salix is the willow family, and Acer is like maples. But Salixed and Acered, I nearly tripped into a stump. All right, I'll just do two more, and I'll end here. Or maybe just one more. This is Ulmus Kansas hybrid. How's that for a name? It's not so Latin, but. An isthmus of dripping, nearly not dawn anymore, greenery, finery, penciled stems, nodule to nodule, and leaves, so seriously serrated they seem utility knives, the cornices of fractals, no nonsense decoration function. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to mention this book is one of Patrick's book, Haiku for a Season, edited by Anna Siko and Patrick Barron. So there'll be copies for sale of that.
As far as Zanzotto's work.
Introduction to Jill. Okay, this is a book that I was able to take in. And when I first started reading Where You Live by Jill McDonough, I was drawn in by the voice and the freedom exhibited with language, the resistance to categories, the unexpected observations and ideas. Jill has published 3 books of poetry, with a fourth, The Reaper, which you will read from tonight, mm-hmm. right? Expected in 2016?
17.
Oh.
Plenty of time.
Okay. She has won a number of awards, 3 Pushcart Prizes, the Lannan Award, a Wallace Stegner Fellowship, for examples. In addition to these impressive accomplishments, she is a teacher, as Patrick is. And the censor is gone. That's the sense I got. Out the window, disappeared in thin air. At the beginning of Where You Live, her 3rd book of poetry, she talks about her students. We are in the classroom with her, in the halls, or the special collections. Yet hers is not the only voice. The poems are replete with other voices and feelings and disagreements. She has lessened the differences between the teacher and student by her manner and tone and the freedom she offers to others, which is radical and terrific. In the poem, quote, on being asked, what is poetry, unquote, she tells the truth at the end, I don't know. But not before she shakes things up. After peppering the poem with the names of famous poets, most dead, some still living, she writes, poetry means you get to say whatever, whatever you want. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Sure. But also, they fuck you up, your mom and dad. There is precedence from centuries past, and recently, of course, from the many poets and writers who broke the chains of silence in the 20th century and since. Susan Griffin in 1976, Adrienne Rich in 1983, Sandra Cisneros' stories in William Woman Hollering Creek. The effects are like the effects of Jill's work. The floodgates were open then, too. By means of her own poetic expression, she is giving students the idea that anything is possible, encouraging them to experiment with language and urging them to ignore people who tell them you can't say that. She has lessened the difference between teacher and student, between prisoner and teacher, between executed prisoners throughout history and the poet who is revealing their words and experiences. As Patrick Barron writes about Andrea Zanzotto, he will embrace the idea that literally everything speaks, and as such, is fit for verse. In the title poem, Where We Live, Jill integrates her own life, mention of Josie, with the teaching of Othello in prison, and various dreams and acts of the imagination. It is a gusty poem, something that is thrown out to us like the force of a wind-filled sail, and includes, near the end, these lines. Quote, I want to be a writer, people tell me, and I nod. Me too. Now, write. Prisons, hospitals, schools, the great cities, their one-way streets and festivals, we put our bodies together, upright and seated, walking along the highways built to human scale, sitting in rooms designed around imagined hordes of you. Prison cell, cathedral, we imagined them, invented, built them around our bodies, or the bodies those spaces would hold. Jill.
Thank you. Thank you. I think
pretty,
you are radical and terrific. Thank you for that. That was really, let's, can we have a nice little, right?
And I'm so happy to be here, and I'm so full of lobster. I'm having a good time. I wanted to start with a poem that I wasn't going to read, but you know, there were lots of poems I wasn't going to read because I'm only going to read a few poems, and I wrote a million. But you with the buttons, Yeah, the buttons of the pilgrims that are getting pulled off in the... So I got to figure out where it is, but I have a poem that talks about being in the prison, and it made... I don't talk about this in the poem, but if you go and teach in the prison, or if you're ever visiting in a women's... Not even a women's prison, any prison... if you look carefully on the ground or of the parking lots, you'll see underwires. Because if you're going through the metal detector, they'll stop you and strip search you if you're wearing an underwire bra. And women are wearing underwire bras, and they're forgetting about it in the until they get to the parking lot, and they're like, fuck, like, now I've got to... I'm going to be late. I'm not going to get to see him. Like, the baby's already crying. And so they just pull the underwires out of their bras and leave them on the ground. And so it's like a little... It's the pilgrimage of the women who love the prisoners that are happening in that space. I haven't figured out how to write about that yet, but I have written this about what I wear in the prison, so I got to figure out where it is. Yeah. Women's Prison Every Week. It's on page 64 if you want to read along, Dorothy. Oh, yeah. Women's Prison Every Week. So I taught with Boston University's prison education program for 15 years before I started working at UMass Boston. So this is a little bit about that. Women's Prison Every Week. Lockers, metal detectors, steel doors, CO to CO, different forms, desks, mouth open, turn. So slow, I use the time to practice patience, grace. Tenderness for glassed-in guards. The rules recited as if they were the same rules every week. I can wear earrings. I cannot wear earrings. I can wear my hair up. I cannot wear my hair up. I dressed by rote. Cords in blue or brown, gray turtleneck, black clogs. The prisoners, all in gray sweatshirts, blue jeans, joked I looked like them, fit in. I didn't think about it until I dreamed of being shuffled in and locked in there, hustled through the heavy doors. In the dream, the guards just shook their heads, smirked when I spelled out my name, shook the freezing bars. Instead of nightly escorts out, I'd stay in there forever. Who would know? So I went to Goodwill, spent $10 on pink Angora, walked back down those halls a movie star. When I stood at the front of the class, there rose a sharp collective sigh. The one who said she never heard of pandering until the arraignment said, okay, I'm going to tell her. Then they told me, freedom is wasted on women like me. They hate the dark cotton jeans they have to wear, each one a shadow of the other, their whole sentence. You could wear red, she accused. Their favorite dresses, silk slips, wool socks, all long gone. Bagged up for sisters, moms, maybe Goodwill. Maybe I flicked past them looking for this cotton, candy pink Angora cardigan, pearl buttons. They can't stop staring, so I take it off and pass it around. Let each woman hold it in her arms, appraise the wool between her fingers. A familiar gesture, second nature. From another world. So I know Garrett likes to sex it up. You know, it's all like sexy stuff with that guy. So I told him that I would read as many sexy poems as I possibly. My first book is all sonnets about executions in American history. Not sexy. My forthcoming book is all about military technologies and robots and drones. Not sexy. But I do have some poems about Josie, who I'm married to. She's in the back. She and Garrett got a haircut together earlier today. Sexy. Not really, but they do have the same haircut. So I'm going to sex it up as much as I can. I'm sorry that I don't have more sex magic going on. Breasts like martinis. What you need to know for this poem is a little bit about martinis, if you don't already know, and I know a lot about martinis. So a bruised martini has little shards of ice in it. A martini should be stirred, but if you shake it, then you're going to end up with more of those shards of ice. A dry martini has less vermouth. A wet martini has more vermouth. Dirty martini, olive juice. You can have a twist. You can have olives. A perfect martini is equal parts sweet and dry vermouth. And I think that's all you need to know about martinis. Except we're thirsty. I know, right? I'm ready. Can you make me one? What do you got in your purse there? You're looking around like, I got this. Breast Lake Martinis. The bartender at Caesar's tells jokes we've heard 100 times. A shoelace walks into a bar, for example. I whisper, Sarah Evers told me that joke in 6th grade. And Josie says, my brother Steve, 1982. A whore, a midget, a Chinaman, nothing we haven't heard. Then a customer asks, why are breasts like martinis? And they both start laughing. They know this one. Everybody knows this one except us. They don't even bother with the punchline. The bartender just says, yeah, but I always said there should be a third one on the back for dancing. Dancing with the woman-shaped air behind the bar, his hand on the breast on her back. So we figure 3 is too many. 1's not enough. Okay, we can do better than that. I like my breasts like I like my martinis, we say. Small and bruised. Or big and dry. Perfect. Overflowing. Reeking of juniper, spilling all over the bar. When I have a migraine and she reaches for me, I say, Josie, my breasts are like martinis. She nods, solemn. People should keep their goddamn hands off yours. How can we tell these jokes to the bartender? We can't. He'll never know. I say it after scrubbing the kitchen cabinets, and she gets it, dirty and wet. Walking in the wind, Josie says, my breasts are like martinis, and I hail a cab. No, she means shaking, ice cold. The only time that I ever got gay-bashed in my life was in San Francisco. I grew up in Alexandria, North Carolina, and I had to go to San Francisco to be, like, for real gay-bashed. So this is a poem about that happening. Dear gay-bashers, the night we got bashed, we told Rusty how they drove up, yelled queer, threw a hot dog, sped off. Rusty, now is that gay-bashing, or are they just calling you queer? Good point. Josie pitied the fools. Who buys a perfectly good pack of wieners and drives around San Francisco chucking them at gays? And who speeds off, missing the point, the pleasure of the bash? Dear bashers, you should have seen the hot dog hit my neck. The scarf Josie sewed from antique silk kimonos, so gay. You missed laughing at us confused. Your raw hot dog on the ground. Josie and Rusty and Bob make fun of the gay bashers, and I wash my scarf in the sink. I use Woolite. We worry about insurance, interest rates, not hot dogs thrown from F-150s, homophobic freaks. After the bashing, we used the ATM in the sex shop next to Annie's social club, smiled at the kind owner, his handlebar mustache. Astrud Gilberto sang, tall and tan and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema, and the dildos gleamed from the walls, 100 cheerful colors. In San Francisco, it rains hot dogs, pity the fool, ass-sized penguins, cock after cock in azure acrylic, butterscotch glass, anyone's flesh tone, chrome. I got a weird email about this poem recently from somebody who was translating it. And I'm, yeah. Well, it was, I think maybe, like, Danish? It was unclear what was going on. It was obviously some ESL stuff that was going on in the email. And she wanted to understand ass-sized penguins. And I was like, those are penguin-shaped butt plugs. And then I was like, how is this my life that I'm writing? I'm writing that, and that's an inquiry. Somebody's asking me what I mean by ass-sized penguins. And I'm telling her. Oh, America. This is one of the poems that Dorothy referenced in the terrific introduction that she gave me that was both radical and terrific. On being asked, what is poetry? I ask that a lot. Ask a lot of students that. Whitman, Dickinson, Dietz, there are hundreds of ways to say you don't know, most of them pretty good. Ann Bradstreet, Ann Carson, Ann Sexton, Annie Finch. Right now I teach understanding literature. They didn't understand that people still write literature, that it's alive. Bishop, Pinsky, Lowell, it took me 3 weeks to make them stop saying they don't like poetry. No to Baudelaire, ditto John Clare, Gwendolyn Brooks. What the hell are you talking about? Don't like poetry, don't like food, vessels, buildings, days, don't like lumber, time, poetry, whatever we say it is, we're in charge. Homer, Akhmatova, Frost. I don't know art, but I know what I like. Here's what I like. Fresh chalk on my hands, marking stresses on the board, a plum, a purple finch, three IAMs, Hopkins, Herbert, Fred Marchant. Then reading aloud from Alan Dugan, who, I admit it, is dead. But not much. The purple prick of that skunk cabbage is still erect in its frost-thawing fart gas. Basho, Bronte, Keats, Berryman, Ashbery, Yeats. Poetry means you get to say whatever, whatever you want. Your poetry, professor, might close the class with Dugan's prick in her mouth. It's poetry, so it's allowed. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Sure. Also, they fuck you up, your mom and dad. What is poetry? What is poetry? I don't know. When I was a fellow at the Fine Arts Work Center, I got to meet Alan Dugan and talk to him about, like, he wanted to meet with the fellows at the Work Center and talk to them about their poems. And he was a million years old, and he was awesome. And I sat with him in this little quiet room. It was very still and warm. And I worked on this poem. I read this poem out loud. And then while I was doing it, I was like, I mean, it's like telling somebody about a penguin-shaped butt plug in an email. Like, it's, you're just like, how is this a real person's life? So I'll read the poem, and then we can talk about what Alan Dugan said about it. Monica at DB's Golden Banana. I pay the $5 cover, say to the bouncer, have you seen her whom my soul loves? Oh, that she would kiss me with the kisses of her mouth. Her name is oil poured out by an unseen announcer before curtains thick and spangled as the curtains of Solomon, Monica. Her banners over me say Wednesday is amateur night. It's Friday. No one can touch her. No one has ever touched anyone the way she's touching herself. Her fingertips are ripened wheat. Dollars fold, extend from our fingertips to her fingertips. Her belly is taut and comely with ornaments. Behold her spandex hot pants, small, forgotten on the stage. Her eyes are doves unseen, her mons shaved bald, her legs long and straight, gone skyward. Her tan and silky buttocks part, display layers of pink labia, tidy, powdered asshole. From stage to cage, until last call, turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle. Your thighs are tan and slender above your thigh-high boots. Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Not one among us is bereaved. Your arms lissom, your grip on the brass pole sure. Your knees roughened, dark from kneeling. Your two breasts are two fawns that lift their pink tongues, nudge aside your tank top. Your hands, birds that tug at your spaghetti straps, pull them down. There is no flaw in you, neon bright, fair as the moon. So I read this poem, I'm like, what, 26? I was like a child. And there's a million-year-old Alan Dugan, and he's listening to me. I'm like, what the fuck was I thinking? This is a terrible idea. I can't believe I'm reading him a poem about a stripper. He's quiet for a long time, and then he goes, the asshole!
is the center of this poem. Like, thank you. I'll consider that as I work on my edits. I'll put the asshole a little more front and center. Bless him. That's a terrific euphemism. Thank you. Cary Grant. This is the height man was supposed to attain. It's all downhill from him. Those silhouettes of monkeys, knuckles rising off the ground, end here. Cary Grant, in the suit he wears in North by Northwest, a hat, a cigarette, a suitcase, things that civilize. The cleft in his chin, a keyhole. The eyes, now onyx, now still water, moonlit. His hair so bright we still know what brilliantined means. We built studios and cameras, spooled film on heavy reels, preserved him for the ages, the best we'll ever be. When Audrey Hepburn asks him, "Do you know what's wrong with you?" she answers for all of us, "Nothing." (3 a.m.) So Josie's a bartender, which is part of why how I know so much about martinis. But it also means that we're often taking cabs at like 4 a.m. Like weird, we keep very odd hours because sometimes she's working until 3:30. 3 a.m. Our cab driver tells how Somalia is better than here because in Islam we execute murderers. So fewer murders. But isn't there civil war there now? Aren't there a lot of murders? Yes, but in general it's better. Not now, but most of the time. He tells us about how smart the system is, how it's hard to bear false witness. We nod. We're learning a lot. I say, once we are close to the house, I say, what about us? Two women, married to each other. Don't be offended, he says, gravely. But a man with a man, a woman with a woman, it would be a public execution. We nod. A little silence along the southeast corridor. Then I say, yeah, I love my country. This makes him laugh. We all laugh. We aren't offended, says Josie. We love you. Sometimes I feel like we're proselytizing, spreading the word of gay. The cab is shaking with laughter. The poor man, relieved we're not mad, he sort of wants us dead. The two of us soothing him, wanting him comfortable, wanting him to laugh. We love our country, we tell him. And Josie tips him. She tips him well. I read this at a the Salem Poetry Festival, the Massachusetts Poetry Festival. Oh, shoot. My bad. Sorry about your rug. It's just water, I promise. And the people who... Thanks. Are you just covering up the water? Oh, no, you were giving me, like, a place to put the water. That's so smart. I was like, that's a really good trick. This is water. So this is a poem that I read, and it was for like a group of high school students, which I was like, oh, I will read the poem about getting drunk and doing drugs with the high school students, because then they will relate, you know, like that's because they watch TV if they're not already doing drugs and getting drunk. And there was a lady who like took all of her kids out of like a teacher like grabbed a bunch of students and like stormed out, which I was kind of thrilled by. I thought that was pretty great. At the beginning of it, I explained that there's a phrase in here that I find that younger people don't. I'm 43. People my age know this phrase, but younger people tend not to. I don't see a lot of people a lot younger than me, and I know you already know it. The phrase is boot and rally. Do you guys know this phrase? This is to drink some. You're like, oh yeah, I'm younger, but I know it. This is a drink so much that you throw up and then go back to the party. Which there was a hush the last time I pointed that out. I want to say that's a good thing sometimes. It's not always like rock bottom. Like sometimes like, oh, it was a good party. You don't want to miss it.
I want to thank you because I've experienced it, but I never knew what the
boot and rally. Now you got tonight. Well, you know, give it another shot. Parties. Life is not one big party that starts right after school. Cora Mannheimer's mother. We couldn't have imagined it, but she couldn't have been more wrong. Sometimes after I take off the knee pads and the house smells like Murphy's oil, I drink a Mexican cane sugar Coke from a glass bottle at a clean Formica table. That's a party. I make a nice supper. We have weekend guests. Grill, light the tiki torches. Cheese plate, box of chocolates, crudité, crackers, cornichon. Galvanized buckets of champagne iced hours before the guests come. Keg of Murphy's or Labatt's and everyone we know. I warned you, if anybody shows up with Coke, I'm snorting it. No one does. Or they're hiding it from me. No dope in the house. It smells like boring. But carry a cocktail, a cigarette, from room to room. Woody asides thrown over your shoulder. Break out the cleavage, all the jewels you own. My sister's telling again how I tripped on her leg in the road. Paul wipes tears of laughter with his new silk tie. Jenny gives a good slow kick and hollers near and hollers far. Bob's running back and forth. I hear Susan's shout of laughter from the porch. Miller's slow dancing, mumbling, Brady, Brady, Brady. Strangers make out in the pile of coats. Somebody sobs on the stairs. A boot and rally breaks the hush of the snow-covered, moonlit yard. You were on fire, making Toronto's last words, making everybody drunk. Cue the ice scoop, shaker, East German dance music, Lauren shotgunning a Schlitz. Oh, remembered Mrs. Mannheimer. Cue the sparklers, smoked striper. Cue the strippers, laughing on the kitchen floor at dawn. It's kind of sweet, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, why would you want to storm out for that? She missed it. So I'm going to read one more poem from this book and then a couple from the new one, the forthcoming one. You can save up so you can afford it in 2017 when it's released. It doesn't... I could come back here. Yeah, there's plenty of time. You will have forgotten all about me.
Yeah, you could,
some of us will be dead. Like, it'll be a long time away. Not you.
Sorry. I know. Sorry.
The odds in the English department
are
definitely
on your side. And that we need to write your book if you came back.
See? I will remind everyone. Thank you. So this one's longer. It's a guzzle. It's two whole pages. And I met Josie in a bar on May 2nd, 1999. And I wrote her a poem so she would go out with me. And this is the poem. It's pretty much the sexiest thing I got.
We're ready.
You're like, I'll take it. All right. Guzzle for Josie. Josie shoulders toward the bar, the height of her enormous in her spine, her hips, in those shoulders previously mentioned, now thrown back. Sudden as a paramour, Josie. Amy grinning, Sandy still, Jen a blur of stick and hair, but it's so hard to pull the eyes from Josie's shoulders, arms, Josie's serious neck, sweet little hardcore Josie. Her hands stronger, smaller than my hands. Her neck stronger, thicker than my neck. Skin paler, more inked up than my skin. Her name over and over. I'm dizzy. Adore Josie. She's a pussycat, said Amy. Pulled me sheepish to the smallish, sneakered feet of this, my muscled idol. I tried to be helpful, speechless, loath to bore Josie. Her brother has a job at NYU. She's proud to own a church bus. I wanted to talk to the base of her spine, to make her blush, to whisper, wanted more Josie. Margie wore a bustier, leather pants embroidered S-E-X. Chris wore a jacket made of feather boa. Beautiful women, powdered, coiffed, poured into clothes for Josie. Speakers give me a headache. I hate having to shout, but tonight I'm talking to no one, watching, listening, small voice sighing in my core, Josie. Who knows if my approach sunk in? A list of what I have to offer, crumpled, damp in her hip pocket, scrawled on a page of calendar for Josie. Are you giving me your past or your future? She said. She asked me, looked up in my eyes to ask, my future for you, Josie. Right half of May, left side of June for Josie. The blue church bus belongs to Josie. It may be even cooler than my pickup. My love, my light, my soul makes me want to go out, cut fresh lilacs for Josie. I want to bring her mango lassie, fill the mango nectar can with lilacs, hang her bedsheets out to dry, toss Caesar salad for Josie. Now, the woman I love, on her hands, sweet Jesus, on her knees, installs flooring. I like to work with my hands. I'd like to lift you to the bath, offer succor, Josie. I want her over me, her left arm a pillar I can cling to, kiss and talk to, while her right arm takes me over, makes me call out, yes, and God, then more, Josie. Leslie said that I'm too femme for Josie. Jay offered other women just as good as Josie, but it's not about the just as good with Josie. Then Tim raised my hopes for Josie. She's on the single side of things, he offered. When I asked if I'm too femme, he said, oh no, she likes girls like you. She's a top, our Josie. Top. I didn't ask what Tim then thinks of me. Church bus, laughter, that lift of chin, her hair. I, Jill McDonough, have something to declare. Je t'aime, je t'adore, Josie. Worked like a charm. Irresistible. Aw, that's so sweet. Thank you. So that's a guzzle. What you guys probably already know, it's all in couplets, and the end of each couplet is a rhyming word followed by a repeating word. So there it's like, more Josie, core Josie, for Josie, blah, blah, blah. The next book has a bunch of poems that are villanelles that are from the perspective of a drone pilot. So there's, like, that's one kind of obsession and repetition. And, the villanelles, I thought, were a good way of thinking about what a drone pilot's life is like, because they're doing, like, these 12-hour shifts, looking at a screen, being 3,000, 5,000 miles, 5,000 up, a million miles away, and then going back to their homes and living a regular life for 12 hours. So their whole life is divided up in these kind of repetitive cycles. And when you read about their like, what they're up to, they spend a lot of that time looking at screens while they're at work. And then, of course, like all of us in their regular life, they're looking at screens. So pretty much everything they do is kind of mediated in the same way that we're always looking at our phones or we're always watching TV. Whatever it is that we're doing, they're doing too in their life and then in their free time. There's a guy that I quote whose name is Lieutenant Colonel Matt J. Martin. And he wrote a book called Predator, The Remote Control Air War Over Iraq and Afghanistan, A Pilot Story. And I published one of these. The first one I'm reading, I published with Truth Dig. And when I did that, he saw it and he wrote me an email and said that he was really moved by the work. And then I was like, I'll show you all of them. I was really, so yeah, he invited me to come out and visit him in Colorado. I was like, right, I'm on it. Thank you. Still death, an unfortunate byproduct of this kind of war. Lieutenant Colonel Matt J. Martin. Predator, the remote control air war over Iraq and Afghanistan, a pilot story. On the screen or on the ground, death observed is still death. Sparkle a target, fire a special K, hope nobody moves. Then it hits a bicycle. One boy pedaling, one on the handlebars, broken, bent. It wasn't there 23 seconds ago. It was insurgents. A whole truckload. We double-checked, declared a clear target. On the screen, or up close and dusty, death observed is still death. Every bomb's a strategic failure, even if it's a tactical success, I heard an F-16 commander say once. That fits with this. Two little bodies on the screen, flung from their bicycle, broken and bent. We saw bad guys burying mortar tubes, fired,
held our breath till a bright flash washed out the screen. Direct hit. Bad guys are easier to watch die, but death is still death, and we're the ones killing. It's not just death observed, I meant. I started calling the predator I hover, I watch, 2 weeks in. So I knocked two boys from a bike, saw it broken and bent. Or sure, bad guys, probably just locals looking to make rent, get paid to pop off around. Do they count as jihadists? On the screen or on the ground, a death observed is still death. I work on forgetting the bicycle, two boys, broken and bent. Armed. Sometimes I felt like God, thunderbolts from afar. Predator could watch the same spot all day. I was a patient, silent hunter. I was armed. Those guys never saw what hit them. You can't get far after hellfire's launched. You can run, maybe pray. Sometimes I felt like God, thunderbolts from afar. When we hit, the screens go white. The house or car or whatever pretty much just goes away. I was a patient, silent hunter. I was armed. I saw bodies, severed limbs, once just parts of the horse the guy rode in on. There were good days. Sometimes I felt like God, thunderbolts from afar. Taking out some asshole when he starts burying an IED ahead of a convoy. Do what it takes for our guys on the ground. Stay patient, silent, armed. You see some fucked up shit. That's the war. You get used to it. You watch and you wait. Sometimes I felt like God, thunderbolts from afar. I was a patient, silent hunter. I was armed. I'll read two more. The first one I'll read is the title poem of the book, and the book is called Reaper. It comes out with Alice James, in a million years. And then the last one I read is a collage made out of the names of top secret, black ops missions in the States. So Reaper, this poem, does a lot of quoting of the Bible and some quoting of some other stuff, but... It tries to look at... Do you guys know about Trinity, the atomic test site? So that's open one day a year. You can go to where we blew up the first atomic bomb. And one of the many things that we didn't anticipate when we invented the atomic bomb was that when we did that first test, we created a new element called trinitite that came out of the ground. It's like the radioactive heat took up some sand... from the ground and then rained it down in the stuff that looks like Coke bottle glass. So I mentioned that in here. Reaper. Oh, not in cruelty, not in wrath, the Reaper came that day. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, The Reaper and the Flowers. Reaper. Just following orders, still death personified. The end of the world, and the Reapers are angels. The Lord is my shepherd, my reaper. I shall not want. Reaper, all-seeing, untired, unbored. The whip-smart Jesus in Matthew 13, he's parable crazy. He makes them up, breaks them down, gather together first the tares, and bind them in bundles to burn them. Good seeds and bad, complicated harvest coming up. Who hath ears to hear, let him hear these metaphors, terrible parables, free for picking up off the ground. The ground around Trinity, the atomic test site, still hot. Break, blow, burn. We breathed sand in, rained it down, in Geiger dazzling beauty, a seafoam green surprise. American ingenuity, foresight, imagination. For whosoever hath, to him shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But whosoever hath not, from him shall be taken away even that which he hath. Code names. By design, this unprecedented expansion was invisible to the American people. Top Secret America, the rise of the new American security state. Above Board. Clear Quest. Able Ally, Allied Action. Just Cause, Even Stevens. Brave Hero, Eagle Scout, Clean Hunter. Project Grace, Noble Eagle, Credible Dove. Cluster Fortune, Bonus Deal, Glory Trip. Fat Cat, Gangster, Privateer, Fast Talk. Crazy Hawk, Twisted Path. Grizzly Hunter, Dull Knife. Epic Fury, Heartache. Face It. Thank you. I sit here.
Is it okay if I give a tribute to...
Oh, that would be great.
Where's Patrick? Yeah, well,
let me sit there so everybody looks at you.
Oh, no. Okay.
You wish.
Yeah, in your dreams, don't you?
So to Jill.
Jill, we are thrilled you dare to give us an MFing sense of where we live. Patrick. Circumambient, Vasco da Gambiant. I love your lambent use of enjambment. Thank you so much. We so enjoy it.
Thank you.